and welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. Nation, His kingdom, His people, and your radio station.
Welcome back to the Remnant Road with, let's see if I can get all this right, Al McCarn, Mr. Barry Phillips, myself, Mike Clayton, and last but not least, author, renowned Israeli tour guide, mom, wife, and very dear friend, Miriam Feinberg-Mamash, all the way from Har Adar, Israel. Welcome to the Remnant Road, Miriam.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Al and Barry. Great to be here.
Well, we're going to spend the hour with you, and just to give a brief intro to you, it was back in 2000, I believe it was. I was on my third tour to Israel, and we had two buses of people. You ended up being on the bus that I was on. And the rest is history, as you became my tour guide on numerous trips to Israel, set the standard for me. And as I told you last time when I was there and you came and spoke to the group, much of what I do today as a tour leader in Israel, I owe to you. And I want to just say on the air, thank you so much for the time, the patience that you had, and for what you put into my life in these years. You've now semi-retired from that, and we'll get into some of the reasons maybe. You do some guiding occasionally, but you spend a lot of time authoring and doing some editing that maybe some people are aware of. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you for that beautiful introduction. And I just have to say right back at you that much of what I do when I still, the few groups that I still take around, I think of you and I think of how you taught the group and the hunger that the group has for the information that you provided. And I like to try and go in the directions that you taught me with my groups. Yes, in the last several years, I've semi-retired from guiding for a number of reasons. One being my desire to spend more time at home with my husband, Arik, who's had some health challenges that we could maybe talk about in a little while. Even more than that, I found that I loved the work I was doing in archaeology and heritage. Some years back, I went back to school to get my master's degree in that subject, archaeology and heritage, and I discovered that thanks to my work with Christians over the years in the field, that is, as a tour educator, I was able to bring something special to that work in archaeology, in editing archaeological works, in translating signs for the Nature and Parks Authority.
And I have to stop you there. You really took a lot of humor out of the land, Miriam. You know, they used to have some doozies over there that we really laughed at. And Miriam goes over there, spoil sport, and decides that they need to translate them the appropriate way.
I didn't realize that. I'm so sorry to have disappointed you. But there are still some bloopers left. Don't worry.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's one on the Galilee. I'm not going to tell you where it's at because you'll go up and try to change it. It says no swooping.
Oh. Well, what can you do? Yeah. I hope
Keep
I can
going.
Do that.
I'm sorry.
I feel like thanks to the work I did with you and others when I was a full-time tour guide, I have my ear to the hearts of what people want to read. I like to think so. And so I can make things comprehensible for people. And that's, I would say, in a nutshell, that's what I'm doing now in all different kinds of areas of heritage, especially for Christians.
Now, you are probably, there's people I mentioned before you came on, there's probably people that have been associated with you, know of you, that really didn't know that they knew of you, because you have written a number of what I would call coffee table books, mm-hmm. the Paul Pot Publishing, and those are Food and Bible. Give us the titles there.
Right. Well, the first one was Daily Life at the Time of Jesus. And that really set the tone for the other books in the series, which were different aspects of daily life in writing them, there's the daily life at the time of Jesus, food at the time of the Bible, from Adam's apple to the Last Supper, women at the time of the Bible. And the last in that series was teach it to your children, how kids lived in Bible days. And what I try to do with those is the same that I do in all my work, is to make things comprehensible, easy to digest, but also deep enough and well documented enough so that people who want to learn more can go and learn, as Rabbi Hillel said. And that's the basis, I would say, for all my work. And they're illustrated in ways that help people see in their mind's eye what things look like, and if they come to the land, if they're fortunate enough to come to the land, to see those sites in the places and those scenes in the places where they really took place.
When I saw you last time, when we were there at the Lev Yerushalayim Hotel in Jerusalem, you gave me a copy of the children's book, the illustrated book, and that is waiting to go in a suitcase and in January be flying off to be given to our grandson, that's Jackson, wonderful. In South Korea.
Wonderful.
So, but you have a real contact with the area that we would call the Arava down at the Dead Sea, and we've talked on numerous occasions regarding Qumran.
Yes.
And some of the teaching that I've done about Qumran and tying Yochanan and the Achor Valley, and why Yeshua was in that area to the Qumran community there. Mm-hmm. And then you also do a lot of teaching regarding Masada, and have mm-hmm. written a book about that. Could you tell us about that book?
That's right. The book that I wrote about Masada is my first historical novel. It's called The Scroll, and it's based on a question that virtually every person who visits Masada asks me, assuming that Masada is quite a famous place, and it won't be a spoiler here if I mention that it was the last outpost, the last refuge of the Jews fleeing from the Romans in the Great Revolt in 70 AD. And that according to Josephus, the Jewish historian, the Jews there took their lives rather than fall alive into the hands of the Romans and spend what probably would have been a life of slavery at best. And every visitor to Masada that I've ever taken around asks me, how do we know the story if everybody committed suicide? And I reveal to them that two women and five children survived, and they all want to know what happened to those women. And because we don't know, that planted the seed in my mind that I wanted to tell the story of one of those women. I wanted to say that Masada, the horrific end of Masada, was not the end, and I wanted to tell a story of hope that would inspire people away from the sadness of that time and that particular event to a better future. So I took a real archaeological find. I discovered in my reading something that's less well known than Masada, that a divorce document was found, not at Masada, but in the Judean desert somewhere else, that of a couple that divorced on Masada and before the fall. And there's that document, which is a Jewish document called a get. It describes the entire agreement from A to Z, whatever needed to be known, including the names of the people. And that really sparked my imagination. Why did that couple get divorced? The stress alone would have been more than any marriage could handle, of being under siege by the Romans. But I had another idea that I like to think is fairly unique. And I took that idea, wrapped it up in the scroll, the ancient divorce document, and brought that document down through three generations until the next great revolt of the Jews against the Romans. And I told the story of three generations of mainly strong women who survived everything life threw at them in this most desperate time of Jews and early Judeo-Christians as well, and came out ahead, came out on top. I wanted to tell that story as a story of hope instead of desperation.
Miriam, I remember being on the tour bus in 2000, and we were not long away from the airport when I distinctly remember you talking about the topography of the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember whether you held up a map of any sort or not, but you were trying to describe to us the Jordan River Valley, the mountains on both sides of that valley, and how that was significant in how invading armies came through and so on.
That's
so
right.
Much of Israel's history can be enhanced and more greatly appreciated by understanding the topography. I want you to know that period of that tour where you discussed, and the reason that this took place is because the mountain range was here or the valley was there, whatever significance the geography, the topography of the land held, you brought that out. That marked me.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that teaching. And I have in front of me a very small topographical map of Israel. And I often refer to that. Oh, yeah. So it's in this valley here, or the Arava, or the Negev, etc. So thank you for that appreciation. I also have in my hand a book that you graciously signed to my wife, Laura, and I when we were there, Israel, the Land of the Bible.
Yes.
So it's here still in my collection.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you. And that idea of the topography has always been very significant for me, especially because I came from another place. I came from New Jersey originally, and I came to live in Israel shortly after the Six-Day War. I came to spend a year of high school here, and when I went back to Trenton, New Jersey to finish high school, I lived, my family and I grew up in a home that was one block from the Delaware River. And I remember after spending that first year in Israel, I came back home and I walked, as I often did, down the block to Delaware State Park. And I stood on the banks of the Delaware River and looked across and tried to imagine what it was like if Pennsylvania was an enemy country. And that I still try and remember that, because the topography is so important in both ancient and modern times. I recently had a gal at my house who's going to be writing an article about my cooking, my food book, Food in the Bible. And the article is going to be about cooking with the Maccabees. It's going to be some recipes in there that are for Hanukkah.
Oh, cool.
And I said to her at one point, you know what? We're doing some oil recipes because of the oil in the temple and the miracle of the oil. So we fried a couple of things and we did, you know, a little olive oil, flavored olive oil. I said, but you know what? I think we're a little thin on Maccabee stuff. So I took her where I live in Har Adar. I took her up to the War Memorial, which is a tall tower. And from that tower, we can see both Modi'in, which we can see the homeland of the Maccabees, Modi'in, on the west. And on the east, we can see where Judah Maccabees' brother Eleazar was killed by a Greek war elephant near the Etzion block, not far from Bethlehem and Hebron. So that, to me, to this day, is very touching, that I can stand, go up on a hilltop near my home and see the entire stretch of Maccabee country at one glance, not to mention Jerusalem, the Mediterranean, all the way down to Ashkelon, Ashdod, the Philistine areas. And they say on a clear day from the tower at Har Adar, you can even see Mount Hermon, but that's 100 miles away. I think that might be an urban legend. I'm still waiting to see.
The clear day is also an urban legend, Miriam.
good one, unfortunately. We can always say, well, it's not clear enough today.
Mm-hmm. Miriam, if I can follow up one quick question. And becoming so well-versed in Israel's ancient and more recent histories, mm-hmm. how has that affected your outlook on life? You're now living in the land as opposed to the U.S., and you've rehearsed these historical events, you know, repeatedly. How has that affected you for where you are now? Do you walk as thinking, okay, this happened, so I make this choice based on what has been done before me? Does that perspective change you in any way?
Can you rephrase
the history that you're so well versed in? How does that shape your perspective for where you are now, living in remembrance of what's taking place in the land?
I feel privileged to walk where my ancestors walked. I have felt that since day one in this country. Just the story that I just told you about the Hasmoneans is a good example. And despite the extreme difficulties of living in this country, the painful days that we have, I can tell you that in 2014, I stood on the porch, on my porch at night, with Arik's home health aide, and we watched the rockets come down. I could see it from my house. The rockets come down from Gaza onto Israel, and the Iron Dome rockets going up. And despite those days and weeks and months where life is so very difficult, I've never lost the sense of privilege that I have to live in the land where my ancestors walked. And I never have seriously wanted to live anywhere else since that sense, that feeling nested in me. It's what some people call being bit by the Israel bug.
That's a good way to put it.
I think that's a bug we all share there, Miriam. And there's, the thing about it, there's no cure for that bug.
No, there's no cure. And in the worst possible moments here, when I thought maybe there's another place for me, and then I settled down and said, no, this is it. For good and for not so good, this is it.
Yeah, because you and I have been, we've been on the tour bus together when your reports came in of bombings, of buses blowing up on at the French Hill bus stop there in Jerusalem. You were there, I think, with me that day when we walked out of the Yad Vashem and found out that Menachem Tovah had been injured. Menachem had been injured up at the Ashah Jeron. These are things that for you are, and every, God forbid this, everyday occurrences, you're seeing something as, I read a report not long ago, the rock attacks that are being, you'd have to have a website devoted just to rock attacks that because of the frequency of them, you just saw something there at Haradar, right, where you live.
Yes.
And Haradar has been a very peaceful area. You told me about Abu Ghosh and how during the Intifada in Abu Ghosh, there was peace between Jews and Palestinian Arabs. Mm-hmm. And the Arabs said this because this is where the Ark of the Covenant was.
Yes, there was an incident in Haradar recently where three people were killed. Three security guards and military personnel were killed. It's thankfully now it's the exception rather than the rule. Those times that we lived together, Mike and Barry, those battle days, I think I think and hope, because I always see the glass half full, are behind us now. I don't believe that we will see a return to those kinds of bombings. There will be other things that we'll face, but I think that those kinds of things are the exception rather than the rule, especially where I live, because where I live is still the bond between Har Adar and Abu Ghosh and the other communities around it is very, very strong and has been since 1948. And we value that, and the people of Abu Ghosh would never have it any other way. As far as others are concerned, we can't know what's going to happen, but I need to believe that we're on a trajectory that's toward the better days, not the worst days.
Now, to give people a little bit of an idea, an insight into the personality of Merriam, if you were to go online, type in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and you would look up the definition for pessimist or optimist. Mm-hmm. You would find usually my name listed under pessimist and Merriam's name listed under optimist.
Mm-hmm.
So, just for reference.
I'll mention that when I completed my very first draft of The Scroll, my historical novel, it was right around the time that Yitzhak Rabin, our prime minister, was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And I ended the book on a kind of a sad note, because I was sad and distressed, and I would say in despair at that time. And my daughter, Maya, whom you have met, Mike.
Yes.
Who's now the mother of two little girls herself.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. She read the manuscript, and she said to me, "Ima, it's a wonderful book, but you can't end so sadly." And I said, "Look, the thing I picked to end on, the event I picked to end on, everybody did die in that event, according to the archaeologist." She said, "You don't know that. You don't know if somebody escaped. You have to leave people with hope."
Wow.
And that was right about the time when Maya did give birth to our eldest granddaughter, who's now six. And I felt that that was my signal, that we cannot lose hope. Whatever direction we go in our beliefs and our religious beliefs and our political beliefs, we cannot lose hope for a better tomorrow. Otherwise,
yeah,
we would never have Israel.
True. We were talking about in the first half hour that before you came on, or second half hour, that we're coming up on an anniversary, 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
Or this is going to be November 27th, 1947, mm-hmm. which gave way to 48. Israel mm-hmm. is based upon we have hope.
Yes.
Because we know the scripture, we see the scriptures true. Yeah. Can a nation be born in a day? Next week is proof that the answer to that is yes. We're going to come back on the other side of the break, Merriam, and we're going to continue our conversation with you. Real quickly, in about 40 seconds, where can people order The Scroll?
The Scroll is available. The easiest way is on Amazon Prime. And just click on Merriam Feinberg Vamosh, The Scroll, Amazon Prime, and you'll find it there to order and be delivered to your home.
And the other books that you've read are going to be on?
Yeah, the other books are also all available on Amazon, Amazon.com.
And if somebody would like, they can just go with us on a tour. You're going to meet Merriam in person, and she does autographs.
Yes, it would be an honor.
At a very reasonable price.
It would be an honor to do it that way as well. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to be coming back on the other side of the break. Music playing here in just a moment. We will return with Merriam Feinberg and see where this program goes. We have no idea.
Worship His holy name. Sing like never before. Oh, my soul, I worship Your holy name. Bless You, Lord.
Come. welcome back to the Remnant Road for November 20th, 2017. This is Al McCarn with Mike Clayton and Barry Phillips. And our guest all the way from Har Adar, Israel, is Miriam Feinberg-Vamosh. Miriam, I got a question for you.
All right.
Okay. Now, first of all, I am so intrigued by your novel, The Scroll, that I think I need to rush out and buy it and read it, because I love historical fiction.
Oh, wonderful.
All right. But you're writing about a period that I don't know much about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the period between the Great Jewish War of that ended in 70 A.D., and then the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135. You said that you have written it with a message of hope, and that is great. You know, for one thing, all that I know about the Bar Kokhba revolt, what hope is there in that? Because it ended up very, very badly for the Jewish people. Correct. Nevertheless, what I want to ask about is this. In writing historical fiction, you have written about a period that the division between, the boundaries between Judaism and Christianity were very, very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, yeah. That word Christianity might not even have been in vogue at the time.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So we could say
they probably weren't speaking English anyway.
Oh. Yeah, apparently, yeah, okay.
If they got beyond the sixth grade, maybe they did.
Well, go figure. Anyway, you write about this time when there's interaction between people who are in the synagogue, and some are followers of Yeshua and some are not, yet they're all part of the same nation, part of the same family. How did that work, and how is it being played out today, or is it?
Yes, thank you for that wonderful question. What intrigues me about those times is the fact that what Yeshua was preaching was something that was so important for the morality of my nation. He was bringing them back to trying to bring my nation back to a morality that many had lost. And I think that as what we'll, for lack of a better term, we'll call Christianity, developed, the supernatural stories that may have been told, the miracle stories that Jews simply could not get their minds around, drew the attention of Jews away from the moral message of Yeshua. And I very much could have seen myself as a follower of that morality at that time. And so I wanted to make clear for both my Jewish my contemporary Jewish readers and Christian readers that was, as you called it, a very fluid encounter between believers in Yeshua and, for lack of a better term, I'll call regular Jews. For example, one incident that I invented was that a person was dying of a snake bite, and there happened to be a believer in Yeshua in that household. And he used healing techniques, which, by the way, I connected to the Essenes, Mike, talking about the possible connection of John with the Essenes and the healing elements that the Essenes were famous for. He did a healing. He laid on hands on that person, and he healed that person. That person came back from the dead or back from a coma, which threw the entire regular Jewish household into a total tizzy. Because that person was healed by a person who was a believer in Yeshua, which they were not. And they really didn't know what to do with it, so I had them going off to ask various rabbis about it and hear what they had to say about it. I believe that the connections in those days were very, very strong, and it wasn't apparently until the end of the first century, as prayer services developed and a blessing began to be said, which indicated a separation between Jews and Jews who believed in Yeshua as the Messiah. But until that time, there was Yeshua, who was unique, and there were others. It was a time of such turmoil that people were seeking answers. And that's what I wanted to make clear, that there were many people who were touched by the moral power of that preaching that we certainly still need today. And in modern times, in our own times, I want to explain this to Jews, and I want to explain it to non-Jews who are looking at Jews and wondering, why aren't the Jews more like us? What is the impediment? What is the obstacle? And I want to make that clear as well.
You know, Miriam, something happened, and we're talking about 1900 years of history here in this split, this division between, I love what you said, you know, Jews and Jews that believe that Yeshua is the Messiah, okay? That's just kind of about as plain as it is, but in fact, these two groups, and now you further complicated it with people like, you know, myself and Alan Berry, who don't have Jewish origin, but have believed that we've been grafted, adopted in to the family of Abraham. And so, you know, a lot of what you and I have done together through the years is trying to mend that.
Yes, exactly right.
You know, it was crazy this time in Israel. Everywhere we went, there was this crowd. And I'm thinking, what do people do with my country here? Because, you know, how many times do you remember us being in a tour bus on the Galilee, the Golan, and we were the only tour bus? We were the only tour group in the Sheraton at the time, now the Leonardo Hotel.
That's right.
How many times did people come to you after the group had been somewhere, had called or kind of taken you to the side and said, Who are these people?
I would say, who are these people in my intonation? And, you know, I want to take that a little further for you. And this is even before all of that time. I probably shared this story with you, Mike, but it was very touching for me that my younger daughter, Neely, when she was in, she must have been about seventh grade at the latest, at the oldest. And there was something about burial customs in the Second Temple times, and she knew a lot more than everybody else in her class. And the teacher said, how is it that you know all this, Neely? And she said, well, my mother is a tour guide, and she works with Christians, and she told me, I heard her tell all this stuff, and she told it to me. And the teacher said, will your mom come in and talk to the group about Jews and Christians? And I said, yes, I would do that. And I prepared a little slideshow with churches. I wanted to show how Catholics love the churches and how Protestants love the open landscape a little more and that kind of thing, just to let the children know about Christian visitors to the land. And one of the kids raised their hand and said, raised his hand and said, but the Christians don't like us. And I said, you know, to me, that's just, nobody I know feels that way. And I said, the Christians that you meet in the land now are your true friends. And the entire class fell silent with that, and so did the teacher. And I hope that I was able to plant a seed there. And I think you, in those years that you came when nobody else was here, you certainly planted a seed. And people feel it very, very strongly. And people know now, Israelis know about righteous Gentiles, if we can borrow a phrase from a different time and a different context. People know about Gentiles who righteously love the Jews, want to understand the Jews, want to be part of the Jewish nation, grafted in, as you say. I remember the first time, long before I met you, Mike, where people were doing something similar to a mikveh in the Sea of Galilee, and they were saying, anybody else want to be mikveh'd? And I asked one of the people, why are you doing a Jewish custom? Are you Jewish? And he said to me wistfully, not that I know of.
I don't know if you remember, we were at the traditional mikveh site, which has been turned into a zoo, in my opinion.
Hello.
Up at the north, you know, that north shore, which I think is preposterous to use the P scale, which I do teach, still teach the four P's of the P scale. I think it's preposterous that that's where Yochanan and Yeshua were. But we were there one time, and I was teaching a traditional mikvah of going under three times. And I actually had an Orthodox lady that walked up to me and said, "Rabbi," and started speaking to me in Hebrew. And I said, "I don't understand Hebrew." She says, "How do you know these things?" Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember, she actually got on the bus with us that day and went up to Sfat with us and hung out with the group the rest of the day.
I do remember that.
So, Miriam, you know, we haven't talked since the tour. And you came and spoke to the group, as I said, in Jerusalem. What we saw back, especially during the Intifada together, has now become not just an openness between the Jewish people that we're interacting with and us, but there's like a yearning for our hearts to be knit together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing this happen right before my eyes. And it's a phenomenon that I'm so enjoying, but I'm all too aware of just how tenuous this is, how 1900 years, we're seeing that in just a short amount of time that we're making such great headway and progress in healing some of the wounds of this family, of this nation, but yet it can be set back. Mm-hmm. We were talking on the break about something that happened, and I don't want you to go into total detail there, but you know, you were telling people, like your hairdresser, and you know, if you want to get the word out to a community, you tell the hairdresser, right? that's multinational. Mm-hmm. But you'd been telling them in those days about our groups that were, but there was something that happened that set that back. Could you kind of expound on that?
Yes. Well, there was a question that was put to a well-known evangelist about what might happen. I believe it was what might happen to the Jews at the end of days. And rather than the warm embrace that I have learned to hear from evangelists, for example, those who say at the end of days, the Armageddon is about what happens to the nations who treat the Jews badly, not so much what happens to the Jews. Rather than go there, this person was asked about what would happen to the Jews, the kind of old-time diatribe against the Jews, what would happen. And that person basically shrugged their shoulders rather than come out with a powerful statement of hope and of the togetherness that whatever the future brings, it's something that we need to face together. And I believe that did indeed do a great deal of damage. It was painful to me personally, because I'm a person of hope, to see that there are still these pockets, these sensations that people have. But I like to say that it's very, very rare these days.
That was actually aired on Channel 1, and I remember you calling and saying, you know, how much that had grieved you to see that. Mm-hmm. And so I take that with me, no matter, not just in Israel, but I try to take that where I go, and keep in mind that we're still on the verge of something, and we need to be careful in this relationship and try to show love. Mm-hmm. Guys, you got any other directions there? We got about 10 minutes here with Miriam.
Yeah, I would like to tag on to what you two have just been talking about. You know, I have been reading Simon Wiesenthal's book, Sails of Hope, about the first voyage of Columbus. Mm-hmm. Folks, what I have learned in that book is more about the Spanish Inquisition than I cared to know. Mm-hmm. And Miriam, when you mentioned that comment by that student in school saying, "Well, don't the Christians not like us?" Let me say to all our audience out there, from whatever background you have come from, if you want to know why this child asked that question, you better study our history. I know enough. I've grown up enough with the Shoah, the Holocaust. I've been to Auschwitz and to Dachau and to many of the sites. what I didn't know is that that's just the tip of the iceberg. This rift between Judaism and Christianity and Christian persecution of Jews, it is going back all the way to, well, that Bar Kokhba revolt that you wrote about. Mm-hmm. And if we, this is why the situation is tenuous right now, because mm-hmm. what we're talking about on our side, Hebrew roots, those who are awakening to the Torah and to understanding and appreciating the Jewish people, and those on your side who are seeing this about, you know, mm-hmm. we're just the smallest part from both communities.
Yeah.
And that's why, by all means, Mirjam, do keep doing what you're doing. We need to help you folks. Go read her books. Go on a tour with her. We got a long way to go, but I do have hope also, like you do, that good. We're going to get there.
Good.
Yeah. Mirjam, I have a question for you, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
From, you know, we as former Christians, people caught in the middle, whatever tag that we can figure out works these days. We have, our perspective, our culture. I mean, that's just what we've been raised in, and that's what we're trying to learn and appreciate. From a Jewish person's perspective, what is it that a Jew would say, this is what Christian Zionist, or I wish that Christian Zionist or Hebraic roots people understood about me, so that when we relate with you, that we do so more appropriately and more effectively? What is it that a Jewish person says, I wish that they understood this about us?
The question is just touches me so deeply, I hardly know where to start. To be frank, I wish that that Hebrew roots people, I wish that, if I may say, all non-Jews would understand the difficulty that Jews have had over the centuries with those surrounding them, to put it mildly, the difficulties, just to put it right out there, what anti-Semitism has done to my people, the distress, the fear that it has planted in my people, that even now that we have our own state and our own land, sometimes we're not able to shake it. And sometimes when Jews respond in a way that's not positive to non-Jews, it's because of that sense that something is demanded of us or required of us that we don't feel should be. And I'm putting it in such careful terms that we say in Hebrew, ha-mevin yavin, the person who understands will understand. I would like to be accepted as a member of the Jewish nation with the history that we have, and I would like people to go and learn as much as possible about that history to understand one individual Jew, myself, or any other Jew that they might meet, that they might encounter, and study and learning, going to a synagogue service, attending a Hebrew class, in your nearest synagogue is all part of that process that I would like to see more non-Jews take part in.
I would certainly agree with you on that, Mirjam. And you said something a little while ago when you're talking about growing up in Trenton, New Jersey, mm-hmm. and your first trip to Israel, and you came back and you were, you know, still a teenager walking along the Delaware River and looking and seeing, imagine if Pennsylvania were an enemy country. You know, there was a time that was true. I mean, really, and that did not become real to me until I was at Washington's Crossing State Park, Pennsylvania. Yes. I mean, that's where Washington with the Continental Army crossed the Delaware River on, Christmas Eve, 1776. And there was the Battle of Trenton and then the Battle of Princeton a week later.
Mm-hmm. I never thought of it that way.
But yeah, it's true. During the American Revolution, folks, it is not that hard to get in touch with your history.
Mm-hmm.
And let me say, Mirjam, when you're talking about your history as the Jewish people, it's our history too, because every mm-hmm. story has two sides of it. And quite mm-hmm. often, we who have come from the Christian side are ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that hard to do. And let me give you folks who are in the United States of America, let me give you a challenge. You may not be able to get on a plane and go to Poland and see Auschwitz. You may not be able to go yet to Jerusalem and visit the Yad Vashem. But especially if you're on the East Coast, get in your car and drive up I-95, go to Washington, D.C., and go to the Holocaust Museum.
Mm-hmm.
It is
or
a
Tampa.
World. Yes. Yes. These are world-class facilities where you can go and very easily and cheaply, I might add, get in touch with the reality that we have got to relearn.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to
have. I want to go back to this a little bit, because for most Jewish people, you know, when I start talking about Ezekiel 37, which, by the way, as you know, there was a scroll found at Masada,
mm-hmm.
and that scroll was Ezekiel 37 of all chapters, mm-hmm. the division of the valley of dry bones mm-hmm. and the two sticks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, much of Judaism is not quite ready for us to start talking in that intimate of terms of saying, you know, maybe we're the stick of Joseph over here, you know, the Northern Kingdom coming home and all these prophecies that are happening. And so for the average Israeli, you know, I go over there, Al, Barry, you know, they see us as somebody different. It's one thing to study your own history, but it's quite another thing and speaks very loudly when you take the time to study someone else's yeah. history mm-hmm. so you mm-hmm. can understand them.
Yes, and that's what I felt in the book that I wrote with my Christian friend, Eva Marie Everson, Reflections of God's Holy Land. She as a Christian and I as a Jew, worked on hammering out several chapters about the landscape in Israel, each from our own perspective. And that was a learning experience that just was incomparable, that she would say something and I would say, well, I can't really relate to that, or the opposite. She would say, I would say something and she would say, but we always found the common ground, and the common ground was through studying our shared text, which is the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it all lies.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, we have 2 minutes. Once again, the scroll, Miriam Feinberg, Bamash, is available on Amazon as well as your other books. You got anything? You also do a little editing. You got a little night job going on there, don't you?
Yes, a little night job, which I asked for the night off, especially for this. It's evening now in Haradar. I work on the news desk of Haaretz newspaper. I edit and mostly translate the news that comes to Haaretz, and it's online and a print newspaper, and that's been a major challenge and a privilege to make the news known, the news in Israel, all over the world, and I'm thrilled to have been doing that for the last 15 years. Learned a lot about the ins and outs of Israeli politics, which is something in type.
We have music playing. Hey, Miriam, would you come back on with us again sometime?
I'd love to. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Al, Barry, shalom to you, to all your listeners. All the best.